It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, 12 of the 20 drunkest American cities are in Wisconsin, according to a recent list. We talked to a researcher about excessive drinking here in the state.
First, earlier today, a judge acquitted a police officer in Baltimore who was involved in the death of Freddie Gray. Gray was a black man who died of injuries sustained while he was in police custody. Prosecutors say Gray sustained a spinal injury while riding in the back of a police van without a secured seatbelt. The officer, Edward Nero, was implicated in the opening moments of Gray's arrest and was acquitted of second-degree assault, misconduct, and reckless endangerment.
Cammie Chavis joins us now to talk about the news. She's a professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University's School of Law. Cammie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
Well, a lot of people have been watching for this verdict. This is the first verdict reached. There was one mistrial that will be retried. So given that there's so much national attention here, what was your initial reaction to not guilty on all charges here?
Yes, so my reaction was, I think, not unlike that of many folks who've been watching this, and that I was not surprised that this particular officer was found not guilty on these charges. I think that, and I want to say that this in no way means, you know, Freddie Gray was placed in the back of that van, and he died of the spinal cord injuries. Freddie Gray did not kill himself. There certainly, to me, seems to be some gross negligence, on recklessness on the part of someone. But we have to remember that there are several individual officers who've been charged based on different actions. And I think that after hearing a little bit about the charges that Officer Nero faced and the lack of evidence, it's not surprising that he was found not guilty.
This seems like a unique case. Part of the charges involved, in effect, a wrongful arrest at the outset, wrongful detainment of Freddie Gray that led to this whole sequence of events, and that the defense attorneys here and some observers have been saying, if he had been found guilty on that charge in particular, this could have set a very profound precedent maybe for other police procedures.
Yes. The criticism, I think, is that if Officer Nero were found guilty by virtue of the allegation was an arrest without probable cause, unfortunately, across our country, lots of folks are arrested without probable cause, and we need to work on that. We need to reform that. There need to be changes in place to make sure that that doesn't happen. But I think to attach criminal liability when it does would have a severe chilling effect on the actions of officers. There are other legal means that don't arise to criminal liability that's supposed to deter that happening. Of course, if there's an arrest without probable cause, any evidence that would be gleaned from such an arrest would not be able to be used in a court of law. We call that's by virtue of the exclusionary rule. However, I understand that that's just not satisfactory for a lot of folks, and a lot of folks don't understand that, you know, when officers do this, that there shouldn't be some penalty.
One thing that's kind of unique in this case as compared to, say, police shootings we've seen around the country is that there are six different officers involved. None of them directly did something that it immediately led to death. They put Freddie Gray, the charges, in a situation where he died of these spinal injuries, apparently, that happened during this drive. Is that going to make it hard in the remaining cases to find someone guilty, given that there's almost this diffuse responsibility?
Well, I think that it can be difficult for the prosecutors in this case. Remember, now these police officers are defendants. They're police officers. They're police defendants. And so the burden of the state would be as it would be with respect to any criminal defendant. The state has to prove each of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. And beyond a reasonable doubt, of course, is a very high burden when we're talking about liberty. We're even if, you know, it's a police defendant, we're talking about issues of liberty. So it's a high burden. And here the officer, I think it's Cesar Goodson, or I may have that name wrong, but one of the officers who has no serious charge, the second degree second degree murder based on recklessness. We do want anyone in society to act without recklessness. And sometimes if you act recklessly, there can be criminal liability attached to that. Whether or not the prosecutors are going to be able to meet the burden under these facts, of course, remains to be seen.
We're talking to Cami Chavez from the Wake Forest University School of Law about today's ruling from a judge acquitting one of the six police officers in Baltimore involved in the death of Freddie Gray. Cami, one thing people are watching for, apart from whether these officers will be found innocent or guilty, is whether lessons are being learned in terms of police procedure that might prevent something like this happening again. Do you see police departments looking at the procedures in a case like this?
Yes, I do. I do, and remember that, you know, Baltimore, that police department, there were internal guidelines as to, you know, when you're transporting a person, that person should be strapped in, because if they're not, there could be injury or there could be death, as we've seen in this case. So, you know, my hope is that police departments all across our country, given lots of recent attention, it's not just the Freddie Gray case, but a spate of other cases as well, that police departments are looking at their policies, procedure, practices, training, and, you know, sending a message that you're there to protect and serve members of the community. And even if you are arresting a member of a community, remember that they have not been deemed guilty until they've pled guilty or been found guilty by a court of law. So we really have to be careful about safeguarding and protecting citizens. I think the issue here is when there's been a mistake or some type of negligence, there's not always going to be criminal liability attached. I do find the fact that Freddie Gray was not strapped in and had these spinal cord injuries, I do think that that's very serious, and I do think that there should be some criminal responsibility for that. We're going to have to wait to see the facts and what comes out with each of the other's officers' responsibility. But again, whether that criminal charge is something related to reckless endangerment or second-degree murder, that's what remains to be seen.
I wanted to talk to you about response to this acquittal. Of course, with the Freddie Gray incident, we saw protests around the country. It reinvigorated the Black Lives Matter movement with demonstrations, some rioting in Baltimore. From what I've seen so far today, it seems like the reaction to this acquittal has been fairly muted, but we're going to have five more rulings over the next couple of months. Are you watching for a potentially angry response if more officers are acquitted?
You know, in this case, you have an officer. These were four misdemeanor charges. And the officer also, rather than a jury trial, the officer opted for a bench trial, meaning that a judge heard the facts in this case, issued the verdict. And oftentimes, it's not surprising to me that the officer in this case chose to have a bench trial. Sometimes the thought is that in these cases, the jury's passions may be inflamed and there won't be the same level of fairness. That was probably the thought there. However, I think that you could see an angry response because, again, as I said, you know, Freddie Gray did not, he didn't do that to himself in the back of that truck. There's some responsibility there. But I believe that we've learned a lot over the last few years that rather than an angry, it's okay to be angry. It's not okay for that anger to spill out into the streets. But I hope that there's been a lot of movement and advocacy so that we can affect real substantial change and desperately change some of the way in which these poor urban communities are policed.
As we wrap up, here in Wisconsin, we have a law requiring an outside investigation when there's a police-involved shooting or a police-involved death. Most states, as I understand it, don't have that. So in a case like this where charges are brought and everything comes to light, hopefully in a trial, do you think that serves the public interest in accountability and transparency, whether or not there's a conviction?
Yes, I think, and Wisconsin really is at the forefront with that legislation that allows that outside investigation, and I do hope that more states will follow suit with that. I think accountability and transparency here are some of the most important things. When you lose legitimacy in the criminal justice system, it's bad for everyone. It's bad for the community that the officers are supposed to protect, and it's bad for officers who have to go into those communities. So it's important that the public have some confidence that these investigations are conducted. First of all, that they're just conducted, right, that you have an investigation, and that when they're conducted in a fair and impartial manner. And I think that there are areas of the country where we have not seen that, and there have been some, you know, very negative responses to that. But I think that the Wisconsin law is a very good start, and I hope that other states will follow suit.
Cammie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Cammie Chavis, professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University's School of Law. She joined us to talk about the verdict released today acquitting one of the Baltimore police officers involved in the death of Freddie Gray.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the secret to success might be old-fashioned luck, according to our guest economist. He says we underestimate the role of chance in our careers.
First, there's a new spotlight on Wisconsin as of last week, one that most people aren't too happy about. According to a new list called the Drunkest Cities in America, Wisconsin has 12 cities in the top 20. Appleton, Oshkosh, Green Bay, Madison are in the top four on Wisconsin and America's list.
The rankings were compiled by the financial news outlet 24/7 Wall Street. They use data from a County Health Rankings and Roadmaps report. That's a program that's a collaboration between the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and Bring It On Home. It's based at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute.
Joining us now is Jan O'Neill. She's an associate researcher and community coach with County Health Rankings and Roadmaps with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation program. And of course, she's based here at the UW Population Health Institute. And Jan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you very much.
Well, your organization provided this data for 24/7 Wall Street. In particular, what do you study there?
Oh, it's a great question. Actually, we have the data on our site at countyhealthrankings.org, and they looked at the measure and then derived the city's rating that they came up with. We actually do a number of things. We rank the health of almost every county in every state of the nation, and we do that as a call to action to help communities see that health is more than just seeing a doctor. It's really about helping communities work on employment and other issues that will lead to good health for all.
So 12 of the 20 cities are in Wisconsin. That's it's pretty significant. What did you make of those findings?
It's certainly true that excessive alcohol use is higher in Wisconsin than elsewhere in the nation. So that's the bad news. That's certainly true. The good news is it seems to be that there's a movement afoot in Wisconsin. There's no longer this sort of this is the way it's always been attitude. In fact, in 60 out of 72 counties, they have adopted excessive drinking as the number one priority issue. And there are a number of really great bright spots around the state, which I can talk about if you'd like to hear about those examples.
Well, first of all, let's make sure we understand what we're talking about. What do we mean when we say excessive drinking? How do you define that?
Well, we actually get our data from CDC, so that's important. We don't make the data up. And the way it's defined is both binge drinking and heavy drinking. So, and we're looking at adult drinkers here. We're not looking at underage drinkers, so 18 and above. And binge drinking is women who drink more than four drinks a day, men more than five in the last 30 days. And heavy drinking would be, on average, more than one a day for a woman and more than two a day for a man.
And one of the articles I read also looked at how many deaths were related to alcohol. What do we know about that metric?
Well, we know that there are 139,000 in Wisconsin who drink excessively, and we also know that there are a number of drunk driving deaths associated with drinking, and I can give you those numbers in just a second here. Alcohol-impaired driving deaths in the U.S., the median is 31. In the state, overall, it's 38%. So that's just one indicator. And then, of course, there's all sorts of other associated issues.
We're talking about a new ranking that came out that showed 12 of the 20 drunkest cities in the country are here in Wisconsin. And we're talking with Jan O'Neill about this, associate researcher and community coach with County Health Rankings and Roadmaps. She's based at UW-Madison. And, Jan, you see some bright areas in this. I mean, mm-hmm. if you look at this list, it looks sort of like a low point and not anything to brag about here in Wisconsin. What do you see that's positive?
Well, what's really great in Wisconsin is that local municipalities, we have a lot of local control. So communities are using and talking with elected officials and others to get some pretty big policy changes made. So, for example, there's up in La Crosse for the upcoming festivals this summer, some recommendations about not over-serving. There's a recommendation that the servers will be sober so that they can see when people have had too much to drink. Those are pretty important recommendations. By Green Bay and Brown County, they're looking to regulate liquor licenses. The number of retail outlets that are that serve and over-serve, that's a really important policy change. That's happening also in Marathon County. They are actually adopting some local liquor licenses with regard to neighborhood input. So they're listening to the neighbors to say what's really been a problem here. And also another policy is social host ordinance, which means people who have at their homes parties and then serve underage drinkers or allow, you know, that to happen, they can get fined. So that's another policy that's being enacted. And I would say that we have some, you know, even here in Madison, some of that trying to regulate liquor licenses is certainly something we're trying to do. And there are a number of other policies that communities can look at on our website at countyhealthrankings.org. And we rate them for effectiveness, so that's a good place to go to.
So it looks as though what you're talking about is at the municipal level, it's cities taking this on of their own accord. Do you see anything coming down from the state level looking at this issue?
Well, I think that what's happening is that as the movement is growing across our state and as the local officials are hearing this grow across the state, I think we're going to see some more changes afoot. I know that in talking with some people that work with the legislature, they're saying that they're feeling a sea change happening. People are talking about it differently because it's not that we're talking about drinking and responsible drinking. We're talking about drinking that harms people, that harms ourselves or harms others. And they're starting to see that change at even the state level.
Still, it's a striking list with 12 of these 20 of the drunkest cities in Wisconsin. And I wonder if you have any insight about what's happening in Wisconsin that's different from the rest of the country. Why would there be 12 cities here?
Well, I don't think it's a surprise that we have a culture that celebrates that. You know, we have a long history of brewing beer and in our state. And we have a culture of it being a part of everything that we do, part of all our social gatherings and so forth, part of our athletics and so on, you know, football games and so on. So it's certainly pretty hard-baked into our culture, but at the same time, as I said, I think there is more and more of a change toward what kind of drinking are we talking about here. And when we say excessive drinking, that's really drinking that is harmful to people.
Do you see this as being something that's difficult to turn around? As you said, this might be a cultural phenomenon about Wisconsin that goes back a long way, has historical roots. So how do you turn the ship on something this ingrained?
Well, what we're seeing is, again, the whole point of our excessive drinking measure in all of the states, and you can look at the state of Wisconsin and pick out which counties have more excessive drinking than others, and certainly the cities are associated with that. That's the point of bringing out this data, is to get the conversation going, and then that helps community leaders and others sort of galvanize from the grassroots up to say, what are we going to do about this? And that's exactly what's happening.
Do you think that's what needs to happen, is to talk about excessive drinking, healthy drinking habits, I guess? Mm-hmm. Because on the other hand, you have a state where beer is something, for instance, that we celebrate. I was just reading an article about different breweries starting up in the state, and mm-hmm. that can be seen as cause for celebration from a business perspective. So how do you walk that line?
Right. Well, what we're talking about here is responsible drinking. So the kinds of policies that these communities are passing, the people that are enjoying a beer or two, especially, you know, at a microbrewery or whatever, that is not what this is going. They're not even going to notice this. We're really, again, talking about targeting and helping those people that really have some serious issues with drinking and creating conditions so that that's not so easy to do anymore.
Jan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Jan O'Neill, associate researcher and community coach with County Health Rankings and Roadmaps. She talked to us about excessive drinking in Wisconsin after a list that came out that Wisconsin has 12 of the drunkest cities in America.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear why luck may play a bigger role in success than we usually think. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk about trauma-informed care and how healing childhood traumas here in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country can have long-lasting benefits on future outcomes.
First, when we think of the things that make a person successful, that put people at the top of their professions, you might think of talent, hard work, resilience, a spirit of innovation.
Our next guest says those can be important, but they leave out another big part of the equation, luck. He says we often overlook the role of luck, and that can ultimately lead us to bad social and economic policies.
Robert H. Frank joins us now. He's a professor of economics at Cornell University. He's the author of Success and Luck, Good Fortune and the Myth of Meritocracy. Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
Well, I understand that this book in part was inspired by a personal brush that you had with luck in a life-or-death situation. Can you tell us what happened to you on a tennis court about 9 years ago?
Yes, I was playing tennis with my regular partner, Tom Gilovich. He's a longtime friend and collaborator. He tells me that during the second set, as we sat on a changeover, I complained of feeling nauseated. And he said that the next thing he knew, I had slumped and fallen from the bench, and I was lying motionless on the court, no breath, no pulse. He knelt to investigate. I had every semblance of being dead. He called out for somebody to call 911 and then flipped me onto my back and started pounding on my chest vigorously. He said it took forever, but he finally got a cough out of me, but then he lost me again. And by this time, maybe 10 minutes had elapsed. And at that moment, an ambulance crew burst in through the front door of the facilities. They cut my shirt off and put the paddles on me, got me revived, rushed me to our local hospital, and then they put me on a helicopter and flew me to a larger one in Pennsylvania. And there I was on ice overnight, apparently, and for 3 days I was completely speaking gibberish from my hospital bed. And then finally on day four, I awoke with a clear head and was discharged the next day, and as soon as I managed to schedule a stress test and pass it, I was playing tennis with Tom again a few days later. But they told me after this episode that what had happened was I'd suffered an episode of sudden cardiac death. And they said 98% of the people who experience that in the field don't make it. The 2% who do make it usually suffer serious maladies of one sort or another, but somehow I managed to escape any lasting effects. And the reason for that, and here's where luck, I think, really did smile on me, was that just before, or minutes before I'd collapsed on the tennis court, two separate auto accidents had occurred close to the tennis center. And one of them did not involve serious injuries, and so the driver of it had been able to peel off when the dispatcher called him and come directly to me. And except for that, I'm not here.
Well, I'm glad you're here, and good luck there, definitely. And you've acknowledged that. So that got you thinking about luck. Now, in this book, though, you're looking at success and career success, and a lot of people would say, okay, you got a lucky break with that ambulance, but a successful, say, business founder, CEO, that's not luck. That's hard work. That's talent.
Of course.
But you say, no, there's a lot of luck in there. Why do you think it's important to suss out how much of that is luck?
You know, the people who succeed on a grand scale in business, their view of themselves isn't distorted. You know, they know they've worked hard. They know they're smart. They've been solving difficult problems every day for 30 years. So most of the time, they really are smart and hardworking. If they weren't smart and hardworking, it's very unlikely that they would have succeeded on any significant scale. But what that all overlooks is that there are millions of people who are smart and hardworking, but they don't succeed in any significant way. And so I think what people naturally tend to overlook is that careers unfold over time. There are thousands of tiny steps. If any one of those steps had been different, if a promotion that you got when you were in your 20s because the person who is a little more qualified than you couldn't accept it, he had an ill mother to care for, and any small step along the way had been different, the whole trajectory would have changed course slightly, and it would have ended up in a very different spot. Maybe it would have been a better spot, but it could have, and probably would have been a much worse spot if you were highly successful. And that's what people kind of lose sight of. It's these little things that happen that ultimately ramify over many cycles into huge effects.
It sounds like something that's really hard to measure. How do you go about trying to assess how important luck is?
I did a simulation, and this is just an example, so it doesn't prove a whole lot, but it gives you an idea of the flavor of what can happen. So the markets where luck matters the most are what we call winner-take-all markets. These are ones where there are really only a handful of top positions. There are thousands, maybe tens of thousands, of people competing to occupy them. And so it's a contest. It proceeds in stages. And if in the simulations we did, it was a pure performance contest. It was absolutely 100% meritocratic. The best performer wins. And we let skill and effort count for 90% of performance, 98% of performance, and luck count for only 2%. And in the simulations we did thousands of them, my assistant and I, what we found was that the most talented contestant almost never wins the contest. Hmm. And that's because the most talented contestant will have just average luck. He won't have good luck or bad luck. There will be many other contestants who are almost as talented as the most talented contestant, and among them, there'll be at least a few who have been exceptionally lucky. And almost in every instance, it will be one of them who triumphs over the most talented contestant. It's not that the winner is not talented. The winner is also very talented and hardworking. But there was somebody the winner managed to beat who was even more talented and hardworking than she was.
Talking to Robert Frank, author of the new book, Success and Luck, Good Fortune, and the Myth of Meritocracy. I want to talk about where luck surfaces in our lives, and I guess it comes up right at the beginning, where we're born, who we're born to. Do you see that as being a big part of the unacknowledged luck that we have, that goes behind success?
You know, people, if you ask them, you know, does it matter that you were born in a good home and raised by caring parents, they will say, of course it matters. They're not naive. They know if they'd been raised in a gang-infested neighborhood by parents without jobs, life would have turned out much worse for them. But when you build your life's narrative, those things don't surface very prominently when you're sort of constructing, how did I get to the top? You know, what you think of is all the long hours you put in, all the hard problems you solved, all the formidable rivals you had to defeat along the way. Those are the things that really shape your life story. And the fact that if you hadn't had a few breaks along the way, those things, they matter. And if somebody points them out to you, you'll concede quickly that they do matter, but they're not the kind of thing that you first think of.
And that seems a key to what you're writing about. It's not just that there is luck that helps determine success, but that there is luck and we don't acknowledge it. Successful people don't acknowledge it. So how does that steer us wrong as individuals and as a society?
Yeah, that's the crux of the policy message of success and luck. The book, if you ask an entrepreneur to describe himself, the most common label you'll hear is, I was a risk taker. Of course, they were talented and hardworking. That goes without saying. But they'll say first, I took risks. And then if you look in the dictionary, what's risk? It's the possibility that something could go grievously wrong. And if somebody took big risks and succeeded, then they were lucky by definition. But the fact that they don't recognize that they were lucky makes them have a sense that they did it all entirely on their own. People will remember Obama's so-called "you didn't build that" speech. That wasn't his message. His message really was, if you built a successful business, you didn't build it entirely on your own. The system played a role. Your parents, your teachers, they had a role too. So the failure to recognize that you didn't do it completely on your own makes people very stingy when it comes to the money that's come their way in the marketplace. You know, they benefited a lot from the investments others made over the last two centuries. They don't want to pay forward for the next generation coming along. And I think that's where the next group is really severely handicapped compared to previous generations. We've been cutting the top tax rates on the high earners. The schools have been getting budget cutbacks. The infrastructure has been decaying rapidly. We're not really investing in the future the way we once did.
We're talking to Cornell University economics professor Robert Frank. His new book is Success and Luck, Good Fortune and the Myth of Meritocracy. He says luck plays a bigger role in success than a lot of us believe.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How big a role does luck play in a successful career? Is it purely about talent and effort, or is luck a big factor, do you think? Do you see a moment in your life that led you on a path, for better or worse, that could just as easily have gone the other way? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about luck and the role it plays in a successful career. Robert H. Frank is with us. His new book is called Success and Luck, Good Fortune and the Myth of Meritocracy.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Do successful, talented, hardworking people always rise to the top, or does luck play a big role? Getting that break, being in the right place at the right time. How did it work out in your life? Was there a moment that could have switched you from one track to the other for better or worse? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Chris on the line in Green Bay. Chris, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Well, I just wanted to say, I think you're calling it luck, where I come from a lower middle-class income family that sacrificed a lot to send the kids to a parochial school for the academics, and once we were like 14, we were getting jobs on our own and helping contribute to family, and through all that, we all came above and beyond whatever our parents had, and I mean, we're not super rich, but we're not poor.
Gotcha, Chris, you're cutting out there. Robert's saying, if a family helps out, if a community helps out, there's nothing wrong with that. I assume you'd probably agree with that.
Sure.
But we talked about, you know, the luck of being born into the right family. That's not the only kind of luck you talk about in your book, though. What other kinds of things are turning points in this road to success?
Oh, I think in academia, my own profession, we see a lot of luck. In my case, I got four or five papers published very quick succession with very short turnaround times. That's never happened to me since then. I think the papers I've written since then, since I was a young professor, are probably better than the ones I wrote early on, but I just got lucky with quick turnarounds and was able to get promoted and stay at a good institution where it's been easy to do my work for the last decades. That could very easily not have happened. And, you know, everybody's got a story like that to tell. What's interesting is that if you try to tell people that they've been lucky, they seem to resist that message. I don't know if you remember the angry reaction to Elizabeth Warren's speech in 2012. She was just trying to remind people that if they'd built a business that succeeded, well, you shipped your goods to market on roads the rest of us helped pay for, you hired workers that the community educated and so on, you should pay forward for the next group. Pretty uncontroversial, but what people seemed to hear was that she was saying, oh, you didn't deserve your success. You don't merit the lofty position you managed to attain. She wasn't saying that, but I think people do tend to resist being told that they were lucky. What's interesting, in my own experience, is that if you'll ask people who are successful to describe any examples of lucky breaks they might have enjoyed along the way, even as you did for your listeners a moment ago, they don't seem to get angry or defensive in the least when they confront that question. They think about it. When they can think of examples of lucky breaks they enjoyed, they want to tell you about them. Their eyes light up. And what we know is that when people have those conversations, when they're recalling examples of times they were lucky, they get much more generous. They can think of many more examples of public investments that they can support. They seem to get happier. Other people seem to like them better. There's just a torrent of good things that happen when they reflect on the fact that they've been lucky. But it's better to ask them about their luck rather than tell them that they've been lucky.
Talking about success and luck, that's the title of a new book by Robert H. Frank, economy professor at Cornell University. You've also, over the years, looked at things like, you know, maybe how a product becomes successful. Or I know you did a study on music and how a particular music can find favor over time. You did an experiment on that. And it's not always the best product. It's not always the best musician who finds success and popularity. What is it maybe that happens early on that picks that winner, regardless of talent and quality?
Yeah, in the book, I describe an experiment. It's not one I did. It's one by a very talented sociologist, Duncan Watts. It was called Music Lab. And in the first round, anyone could go to the Music Lab website. There were 48 indie bands with one song each posted on it. You could download any song for free on the condition that you give it a rating. How much did you like it on a scale? That was their measure of the objective quality of the 48 songs. Then what they did was they did 8 separate websites. Different people visited the different ones. And they saw the same 48 bands and the same 48 songs, but in addition to that, they saw how many times each song had been downloaded and what quality rating it had gotten from downloaders so far. And what was really interesting was that songs that ranked in the middle of the quality distribution could either succeed or fail, and the difference was dramatic. One particular song was ranked 26 out of the 48 in the objective rankings. It became number 1 on one of the 8 websites. It was number 40 on another of the 8 websites, and the only difference was, did the first people who downloaded the song happen to like it? You know, most of the songs on offer were ones that some people liked and others didn't. And so if the first ratings they saw of your song were positive ratings, then the song tended to rise in the rankings and do quite well. If the first ones people saw were negative rankings, then or ratings, then it would tail off to the bottom of the rankings list. So just pure dumb luck. Did the first people who heard your song happen to like it?
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Emily on the line in Madison. Emily, hi.
Hi. I have a great example of exactly what you're talking about with academic success. When I was in high school, I got a scholarship to UW-Madison, and our school had a valedictorian scholarship for 4.0 students. That year, there were seven students with a 4.0, so the scholarship was split seven ways. Well, I happened to get a 3.9, so I got the next available scholarship, but I got the whole thing. It wasn't split with anybody.
So you got more than the 4.0 students.
Yeah, so those people who were, I mean, I was really hardworking, too, to get a 3.9, but.
Sure.
Well, Emily, that is good luck. And you say there's weird things like that, like sometimes in certain fields, having a last name with the letter A will bring you more benefits than later in the alphabet, the time of year you're born. Fluky little stuff like happened to Emily can make a big difference down the road, Robert.
Yeah, it's when you see all these examples, I think you naturally feel a little bit more humble about where the rewards got doled out. Yeah, you were good, you worked hard, but probably you had a break or two along the way.
Emily, thanks a lot. Congratulations on the runner-up status there. So, Robert, what kind of lessons are you hoping people take away from this for their own lives and maybe as they think about what public policy should look like?
You know, the tragedy is that I think prosperous people, when they're lobbying so hard for tax cuts, I think they're sincere. They believe that they earned every cent on their own, that they didn't get any breaks. They're entitled to all that money. And they also seem to believe that if they had less money left over after taxes, they'd be much less happy than they are now. They wouldn't be able to buy as much of what they want successfully. But that's just not the way the evidence points. If all the prosperous people paid a little bit more in tax, we could increase the Pell Grants that poor students get to go to college and do a whole lot of other things that, you know, everybody agrees would be a good thing to do. And the rich people, the prosperous people who were paying a little more in tax, would still get just as much of what they want as before. And that's because if you're prosperous, what do you want? You have everything you need. You want something special, the stuff there's not enough of. Maybe it's a home site with a view or a painting that others want to. So how do you get those things? You bid against other prosperous people, and the high bidders end up getting them. And what people overlook is that if their taxes go up a bit and everyone else like them pays more too, those bidding contests get settled in exactly the same way as before.
And we'll have to leave it there. Robert Frank is professor of economics at Cornell University. Thanks to him, his new book is called Success and Luck, Good Fortune and the Myth of Meritocracy. We're always keeping tabs on exotic wildlife sightings in Wisconsin here at Central Times. When we saw this thing reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the Wisconsin State Journal, we had to pay attention.
That's right. The sheriff of Grand County in southwestern Wisconsin is warning residents to watch out for a large snake, possibly a python. And it sounds like it's actually a really big snake or python.
The snake was spotted in the Dickeyville area early yesterday evening, crossing Highway 61. Apparently, according to some reports, it was as long as the width of both lanes of traffic, according to the sheriff's Facebook page, though at least one local snake expert has been quoted saying that might be exaggerated.
The sheriff's department actually tweeted about this, warning that people should keep an eye on children and pets, and says that civilians should not try to capture the snake. Just call 911 if you see it, and they say they have a plan about how they're going to tackle the snake if it turns up.
Right. I think that warning would be unnecessary in my case. I think I would not personally try to apprehend the ginormous python or whatever kind of constrictor snake.
That must have been quite a sight, though. A snake the size of two lanes of traffic crossing
supposedly.
A road in Wisconsin.
Supposedly. We'll see if it turns out to be that big. You know, and we still haven't found, by the way, I need an update on this, the Milwaukee Lion.
Oh, yeah, the Milwaukee Lion. Whatever right. happened to the Milwaukee Lion?
All right, keeping you informed of all random exotic wildlife sightings in Wisconsin, this is Central Time.